Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 60, right at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 685. Okay, so in the preceding session, we made it through to the end of the Paleozoic, and now we're ready to start that middle of the three eras, hence the name, the Mesozoic, and it's the Age of Reptiles, you know, basically, the Mesozoic. And you know, recall what we were doing at the end of the preceding one. The planet just went through, you know, the great tribulation, if you will, mass extinction of the Permian period. Okay, and so we've taken out more than 99.5% of the species that were superfluous to the ultimate purposing, you know, that's in play on the planet. We talked a lot about how significant that is as a parallel to thinking about the nature of transitions, like the great transition that civilization is in the midst of here for the next 1,000 years. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be mass extinction, but there certainly can be a very significant disruption of the established order in order to make a transition. There's a distinct purposing, and any line of purposing inherently involves definitive transition stages, where all things are passing away. Behold, all things are becoming new. We're reminded again that we're reading about all of this early evolution of life. But there's only one fact in truth in play. It's all the evolution of humans. There isn't any other evolution, fundamentally, in truth. The purpose of the universe is to be inhabited by will creatures, not by cephalopods. Okay? It's all about the humans. And so when we saw that great paring down of all the species, you're getting to the core essence of what's fundamentally pre-human. Right? What that thread of truth of humanness is that's going through that little neck in the whole distribution of species. There's this definite little opening that everything, squeezed through, and most things couldn't fit. Right? Yeah.
Were those things essential, even though they had to go away eventually? They still contributed things that didn't work.
Right. So, when we think back prior to the Permian extinction, you have two things in play. You have what's in play on every evolutionary world. Those are all part of the process of getting to humans. But then there's also, on this world, some facts that aren't directly part of the process. Because it's an experimental world, there's some tangential things. Now, obviously, indirectly, they're part of the process, or they wouldn't have come into existence in the first place. In order to get the lines going forward that you want on an experimental world, there's going to be a number of lines that also come into existence that are just dead ends. They don't fundamentally go anywhere. But you can't make the one without the other. You know, in a big picture sense, it's like that fact that you can't give a human creativity without giving him the potential of destructivity, right? You know, the processes are always fundamentally that way and in an evolutionary mode. Okay, so anyway, you know, that's what we're immediately in the wake of. You know, remember that we have things pared down to this fundamental essence, and now things are going to burst forth again in a new mode, very much making that shift, as you can see from the title of the paper, shift from you know, the primary domain of evolution being in the oceans to being on the land. Okay, yep.
So you mentioned in the beginning about, you know, the cataclysmic redirection or whatever you want to call it, the next 1,000 years and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And that maybe you're going to be, you know, they're accompanying, that's why the revelation is here, etc. Can you speak to, was there a similar redirection in the last revelation when Jesus came? And in terms of, you know, for one to imagine what that might be in our you know, not necessarily in our lifetime, because we may not be here to really recognize it all, but what might be unfolding?
Okay, so, I mean, you don't want to think about what's afoot for the next 1,000 years as a redirecting cataclysm, necessarily. I mean, those are always in play. This, you know, the Permian extinction wasn't a redirecting. You know, it was just a paring down to the core of the process. When you go back 2,000 years, you had a minor spiritual quickening event that prepared the soil for people to be receptive of the message that went forth from Palestine through the apostles and disciples. But it's not like.
And then the spirit of truth that allowed thought adjusters to come.
Right, right. You had the universal bestowal thought adjusters and all that. But you know, you didn't fundamentally have. You weren't in a transition mode. We're in one of the great transition modes in the whole evolution of civilization.
Not
just biologically. I mean, mostly civilization is a mindful spiritual evolutionary process. You know, it's predicated on a biologic process. But, you know, it's fundamentally an evolution of the collective consciousness that's expressed as the civilization. And you have those developmental epochs, and we're moving towards the end of the material comfort era, quivering on the very brink of the possibility of definitively, at least the spear point of humanity, moving into the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Okay? And that the reason that that's such a huge transition, as opposed to going from the new, you know, the nutrition epoch to the security age, say those first two developmental epochs, because this we're in the transition between early progressing civilization and advancing civilization, and that involves a fundamental reorientation, reestablishment of the foundational indispensables. In the early process of progressing civilization, you have four indispensables: slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. Those are the indispensables that fundamentally drive the progress of civilization. You transition from those, and you know, all sorts of reforming of institutions and whatnot that's involved in it, into the advancing half, you know, or phase, where the four indispensables are true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. Okay, that involves just a radical transformation of everything. I mean, everything has to just be totally redone. It involves a lot of chaos, especially on a world like ours where we don't have overt people managing that for us, right? The prince and his staff, Adam and Eve, whatnot. We've got all of this complexity, not just because of the rebellion and default, but because it's a decimal world. So it's we're in a very loosey-goosey state, trying to get to a much more definitive, focused state. Does that remind you of something we just read? Prior to the Permian, you know, you got species all over the place. It's this very loosey-goosey state of biologic evolution. And it's going to end, you know, afterwards, it's down to a very focused expression. See, it's a very similar process.
What were those four again?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. What were those four?
Right. Of the advancing?
Yeah, the advancing.
Right. True religion.
True religion.
True monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. If you search the book, if you search the book for indispensable, and you look for just the issues that are indispensable to specifically the progress of civilization, not other aspects of civilization or, you know, or other issues, but just specifically to the progress of civilization, you'll see there's eight, and I'm giving them to in the order. Early order is slavery, war, social classes, profit motive. Followed by true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. Okay, and note the true, not religion, not merely religion, not merely monogamy. No, true religion, true monogamy. Mallard ducks have monogamy. Okay, that's not what we're talking about. Right? We want true monogamy. You know, there's a whole section, you know, entitled True Monogamy, you know, where that indispensable occurs.
Is this the age of education that they talk about?
No. I mean, it's like I said. I mean, in terms of the developmental epics, it's when you're beginning to move into the philosophic phase.
It is.
Right, the beginning of the philosophic phase, you know, that culminates in light and life, is the quest for knowledge and wisdom.
But in between security.
So you have this. You have this.
Education.
You have the nutrition epic, the security age, and then the material comfort era. After that, you go, you know, you go forward into, you know, more and more philosophic, you know, phases. You know, we don't need to go into all those details. That's not the point right now. I just brought up that to stress that this is, keep in mind, if nothing else, flowing through all of these facts about dinosaurs and whatnot, okay, is a truth that you're in the midst of right now. The same truth playing out in a different circumstance. Right? They're the truths of eternity. They apply universally to all places and all times. And so you're seeing that same pattern. This is very relevant. It's one of the reasons you can recognize why all this paleontology is here. I mean, one of the reasons is to help paleontologists so there can be true science in that mode at some point, yes. But there's bigger things of, how it's relevant to why this book is in my lap in the first place. Why the super universe mobilized to see to it that this book is in my lap, right? Because we're in that period, a very definitive transition time that's not going to settle down for 1,000 years. You know, and no one has even imagined the level of of upheaval that this is going to involve to make this transition.
Change.
Okay, lots and lots of change.
Thank you.
Okay, so you can kind of between the lines of about we're talking about to talk about reptiles. You can think about how. You have an expression of what comes in the wake of you know, one of these big transitions. You know, and in terms of it, you know, being expressed in this case as a reptilian phenomenon. Okay? Yeah, so it may seem very different. It may seem very different, you know, that this reptilian age is somehow parallel to, you know, the beginnings of advancing civilization, you know, for us civilizationally. But there's a parallel there. I mean, we're going to go from very rudimentary phenomena to, you know, much more significant sorts of phenomena, you know, and in very short order, you know, it starts really getting to the point. You know, you see what's been kind of fuzzy and not very well focused for a long time, and for hundreds of millions of years, starting to come very definitively to a focus, you know, to the point where they have to even, you know, for too long, decrease the time steps that they're taking. You know, even stepping along in 10 million year chunks, you know, things start to pick up. It starts, you know, it's not just an arithmetic phenomenon. The more you have a spiritual influence definitively starting to manifest in the biologic evolution, right? Remember, that spiritual influence is what's giving it an anagenesis, an upward evolution, a progressing phenomenon. And seeing right there, you see the parallel. I was talking about how specifically that was about the progress of civilization, right? You're really focusing, you know, they don't focus that much on the horizontal evolution, you know, of things adapting into various niches and whatnot, you know, in, you know, Darwinian observation fashion, right? I mean, the whole point is not the adapting horizontal, it's the progressing vertical. It's like the progress of civilization. It's that vertical component. And so, and we're seeing, or we're given the opportunity to reflect on the parallels between progressing civilization and progressing pre-human biology. Okay. All right, so let's get into it here. You'll see that a lot of this is, you know, is fairly straightforward. We'll probably step through it a little bit quicker, unless we get off on tangents, which we usually do. But you'll see it kind of is more of a, we've sort of really gone through a lot of the rudimentary issues already, and it's going to take on a more dunk-a-dunk-a-dunk, you know, just sort of a nice little step sort of a character here. Okay, so let's read a little bit here.
Paper 60, Urantia during the early land life era. The era of exclusive marine life has ended. Land elevation, cooling crust and cooling oceans, sea restriction and consequent deepening, together with a great increase of land in northern latitudes, all conspired greatly to change the world's climate in all regions far removed from the equatorial zone.
All right, so just a quick little reminder, that was another biggie. That I didn't specifically reprise because they do it right there. I remember that was the fundamental mechanism for that transition was, you know, we were finally transitioning from that long established fair and even marine climate to the beginnings of continental climate. And so very radical change, you know, both on land and in the oceans. It wasn't just land species that died off. All species died off radically because everything changed. So, you know, we talked about that. It's just kind of interesting that here we are, you know, everyone tending to run around with their hair on fire about climate change now, too. Yeah, and they gave you a nice little summary there, see, of all the specific issues. And just the one I'll highlight, because it goes forward here, remember that we have very much cooling crust. We're getting close to the end of specifically continental drift and making that transition to plate tectonics. because of the cooling crust. It's getting more and more rigid. Things are going to, you know, they're not going to be able to just ooze about, you know, like they used to. Things are going to start to lock up and come to screeching halts and, you know, grind together and stuff as this really starts to solidify.
You get step changes.
Yeah, right. Things are just, going to crash and break. And so that's what's coming up because you have this.
So do you think prior to this time there was really strong earthquakes?
No, there were earthquakes. You know, they mentioned that, if you recall, there were times. You know, yeah, it's just, you know, in general, there were kind of earthquakes in a little bit different mode than now.
Okay.
Right? All right. And you notice that you're getting to something that's quasi-recognizable. You know, great increase of land in northern latitudes, right? I mean, you know, you definitely have that differential between the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. Okay, so you read that other little one there.
The closing epochs of the preceding era were indeed the Age of Frogs. But these ancestors of the land vertebrates were no longer dominant, having survived in greatly reduced numbers. Very few types outlived the rigorous trials of the preceding period of biologic tribulation. Even the spore-bearing plants were nearly extinct.
That just kind of speaks to what I was talking about extensively before, and you're just reminded, why aren't there 500,000 different species of amphibians, you know, everywhere in all sizes on the earth, you know, or why aren't we dominated by spore-bearing plants, you know, as opposed to seed plants? Because those are the old order sorts of things, basically. You know, the extent to which the extent to which they're still here, you know, is just the extent to which they, you know, their tails, you know, feed forward in time, but those were transitional sorts of modes in many ways. Okay, so now let's get to the point. What about the age of reptiles here? I'll say up front, there's three periods to the Mesozoic, you know, which most people have heard, because a lot of times it's, you know, if you're familiar with any of the geology around you, you know, you've probably heard Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous. Okay. There's always movies too, right? We're going to be starting with the Triassic. Paused here. It's called the Triassic because it sort of has kind of three different stratigraphic parts to it: a lower part, a middle transitional part, and an upper part. So three Triassic, okay? And the lower part is the great big red beds that you see, you know, like if you go up Wyoming. So we're there finally to those big red beds of the Triassic, if you're familiar with Wyoming or South Dakota, say. And if you're driving around there, you know, you may notice that there will be a little cap of, you know, in some areas, gypsum on top of the big part of the red beds. That's that middle chunk that transitions to the stuff above it. You know, so those are the three parts. Okay.
Section 1, the Early Reptilian Age. The erosion deposits of this period were mostly conglomerates, shale and sandstone. The gypsum and red layers throughout these sedimentations over both America and Europe indicate that the climate of these continents was arid. These arid districts were subjected to great erosion from the violent and periodic cloudbursts on the surrounding highlands.
Okay, so see, notice now they're making note of, in contrast to what they told you before, remember when we were back in the Devonian? And they mentioned the red sandstone, and, you know, particular in Britain, that's the old red sandstone, as it's called, in contrast to the new red sandstone. Remember how they said, unlike what you think, that wasn't reddening produced by aridity. That was different. Here, see, it is. right? You have, because we have continental climate now, right? So you can have extensive arid regions. You can have, you know, these evaporative areas that are leaving gypsum deposits and stuff like that. All right, so we're in that. We're definitely in that mode with these red beds now. You know, you can just imagine, you know, all of the, you know, remember you're thinking about all of the continent that's been built up is getting eroded down and piling up, you know, in the shallow, immediate coastal regions, you know, is this huge red bed. And it's all reddened, you know, because it's coming off of this arid continent. Okay.
Few fossils are found in these layers, but numerous sandstone footprints of the land reptiles may be observed. In many regions, the 1,000 feet of red sandstone deposit of this period contains no fossils. The life of land animals was continuous only in certain parts of Africa.
I see. Just so little reminders like that, it's a rougher environment, and so, you know, there's only a few places that have long-term constant character where you don't end up having a lot of die-off of species. So it's a lot more rugged, and so think about this, you know, the parallel, right? The Supreme has moved us out of the sheltered bays. Right, and we're moving out onto the high seas. High seas are rugged. See, we've moved into a rugged, you know, domain of evolution here. The animals have to deal with all of the difficulties of being on the high seas in terms of climate, you know, and we'll have to deal with all the difficulties of being on the high seas in terms of civilization. Right? And so that's why we need, you know, we need to be definitively getting to the quest for knowledge and wisdom. In that order, remember, not wisdom and knowledge, knowledge and wisdom. You know, right now it's at best wisdom and knowledge, and mostly it's just knowledge. Right? You've got to flip it around where knowledge is not the foundation, and you're trying to sort of basically magically exalt yourself up to wisdom. You need to get at things from the top down. You need to have the foundation be wisdom and have your knowledge predicated on that wisdom. Right? In order to have the frame of mind to deal with the difficulties, you can't just be in the mode where you can only learn by leaping, right? And you have some knowledge, you know, and you get into a difficult situation, like, I don't know, how do I apply this knowledge? How about this chunk? No, that doesn't work, you know, and oh, now we've sunk, right? You need to be approaching it, you know, in a holistic way to begin with. Right, and the knowledge is your toolbox. You know, you have the framework, and you I need that crescent wrench right now, and now I need my Allen wrench, whatever. Right, life is going to is evolving now in that environment, where it's going to take on the challenge. The adaptive challenge of all of this complexity and variability. Okay?
These deposits vary in thickness from 3,000 to 10,000 feet, even being 18,000 on the Pacific coast. Lava was later forced in between many of these layers. The Palisades of the Hudson River were formed by the extrusion of basalt lava between these Triassic strata. Volcanic action was extensive in different parts of the world.
If you're not familiar with the Palisade Cliffs along the Hudson there, you know, New Jersey and New York, you know, like around the George Washington Bridge, they're talking about there, those big cliffs. Notice the little twist they threw in. You know, we've been noting when they would give us a little examples of, oh yeah, then there's volcanic activity here, like interleaved. Yeah, be careful. Sometimes it's not, you know, right, you know, it's not, you know, just purely in sequence, you know, where you've got, okay, you got this sand, this sandstone, and then there's some igneous slate on top of that, and then there's some, you know, some shale or whatever. You know, sometimes you have the sedimentary stuff in place, and then, you know, igneous gets squeezed in between, right? So it'll, you know, if you just assume that was, you know, the same date, you know, you would have way too recent a date for the sedimentary rocks. You know, if you just went by what you can date, the igneous rock, you know, when that igneous rock crystallized. I'd say, just a little reminder, you know, scientists obviously understand that sort of stuff, you know, but that's a complexity, so you have to deal with. You've got to figure out if this was, you know, laid down in sequence, this igneous rock, or not. All right, go on here.
Over Europe, especially Germany and Russia, may be found deposits of this period. In England, the new red sandstone belongs to this epoch. Limestone was laid down in the Southern Alps as the result of a sea invasion and may now be seen as the peculiar dolomite limestone walls, peaks, and pillars of those regions. This layer is to be found all over Africa and Australia. The Carrara marble comes from such modified limestone. Nothing of this period will be found in the southern regions of South America, as that part of the continent remained down and hence presents only a water or marine deposit continuous with the preceding and succeeding epochs.
Right. So sometimes, you know, pointing out in some regions, you don't have a definitive change in, you know, beds as you go from Permian to Triassic to Jurassic, for instance, in this case. I think probably a lot of people are familiar, you know, how, you know, what once was down at sea level, you know, and was limestone being laid down, you know, it has gotten shoved way up, you know, into the peaks of the Alps, right, since it was laid down. And so you've got dolomite type of limestone. It's not just purely calcium carbonate, it's got magnesium. It's calcium magnesium carbonate, dolomite. That's that modified limestone they're talking about. And you can obviously, that could get really, you know, heated and compressed and be turned into marble, like they're pointing out. So you'll get like the Carrara marble. Okay? So if you were a devotee of marble types, you go, oh, yes, the Carrara marble. And then see, sure enough, there it is, the new red sandstone, see, right? Even though they didn't literally say the old red sandstone before, right? Here, you know, here's what that is in contrast to. Oh, yeah, and they've mentioned that this is done by Arid. It's all there for you just to notice. They don't pedantically spoon-feed it to you. But, you know, the very fact that, you know, you're reminded of, you know, limestone clear up, you know, high in the Alps, it's not like we've gotten to a point that's so recent that the Earth doesn't undergo, you know, a lot of radical changes still, you know, and the whole southern part of South America being under, you know, down in the ocean and all this sort of stuff. Okay, I mean, there's still lots and lots of changes to occur on the Earth, like we've seen incessantly ever since we started reading this in the history of the Earth. Okay, keep going.
150 million years ago, the early land life periods of the world's history began. Life, in general, did not fare well, but did better than at the strenuous and hostile close of the marine life era.
Just a quick little comment. So now we're officially beginning the Triassic. I mean, that was just a little preface we were reading before. Triassic began about 150 million years ago, actual date. And we're in the multiple still. I was just about to say that. that was the sentence you did. Right? And that ratio is still at its, you know, remember how it started at 1.4 once it finally settled down, and it's been slowly ramping up, and it's in the 1.6 ballpark right now. And it's in this peak right in here, and then it starts to go down. And I'll note that as we go forward. About 1.6 times 150 million is what the radiometric date the scientists are getting, for this. And you can see that it's better than the cataclysm before, but it's still pretty rugged. And that, just saying it that way, I know what the truth is there. Right? That whole bit of truth is rugged. Right? And the life is experiencing how rugged truth is. In order for truth to flow through this evolutionary process, sometimes things get really rough factually in the moment, right? And you don't want to judge God's favor by looking at how rugged the facts of the moment are, right? God's favor is not in the facts of time. It's in the truths of eternity.
But I don't like truth being rugged.
Yeah, well.
If you think of where the so-called chosen people lived, mm-hmm. They're in the Levant, where there's contending armies marching through. They didn't have much protection.
Yeah, not to mention it's right in the middle of where a bunch of plates come together. It's an extremely active geologic region right in that neck of the woods too. All right, rugged truth. All right, keep going here.
As this era opens, the eastern and central parts of North America, the northern half of South America, and most of Europe and all of Asia are well above water. North America, for the first time, is geographically isolated, but not for long, as the Bering Strait land bridge soon again emerges, connecting the continent with Asia.
Remember how they mentioned it for a long time, because it was just continental drift. Things were shifting about, but you almost always really had at least isthmuses connecting things and stuff. It was really kind of still one continent in many ways, but we're definitely moving away from that. You can start to get some definitive isolation and stuff. Didn't they mention here? Yeah, the consequent deepening, along with the sea there. I see. It's not so much just one continent with shallow stuff. You're really starting to get deep oceans separating continents. It's starting to move into that mode now. Okay. Again, it's hard to imagine things being connected now. It's like, well, this is a great big huge deep ocean. How could there possibly be a land bridge? It's like, well, there wasn't a deep ocean back when there was a land bridge. And,
that's how the Red Band came.
Yeah, and then of course, we have the, they're reminding you. It's like you know about this, right? You got the Bering Sea, the Bering Strait. That's very shallow. And just imagine how everything used to be kind of like that, except for the one ocean, basically the Pacific. Right? That's the big story. Like I said, that you're starting to see this definitive shift towards plate tectonics. Okay.
Great troughs developed in North America, paralleling the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. The Great Eastern Connecticut Fault appeared. One side eventually sinking 2 miles. Many of these North American troughs were later filled with erosion deposits, as also were many of the basins of the fresh and saltwater lakes of the mountain regions. Later on, these filled land depressions were greatly elevated by lava flows, which occurred underground. The petrified forests of many regions belong to this epoch.
Again, the basic point is just, if you're not familiar, just reminding you how complex things can be. You may have something very definitive in terms of a bed in this region, But it's not very extensive because it's just in a trough, you know, that was there at one time. And so it's not like a, you know, a bed that goes over the whole continent or something like that. Yeah, and you can definitely see you've got some big faults, right? A 2 mile offset, right? You know, vertically on that fault line. And so things can, you know, are definitely, you know, moving about vertically.
Underground lava flows pushing up the...
Right, you get these big intrusive, you know, this intrusive volcanism, not extrusive, but intrusive volcanism, right? And the stuff above gets bulged way up, you know, as a big magma pool is pushed in there. Yep, okay.
The Pacific coast, usually above water during the continental submergences, went down, excepting the southern part of California, and a large island which then existed in what is now the Pacific Ocean. This ancient California sea was rich in marine life and extended eastward to connect with the old sea basin of the Midwestern region.
Stuff like that is just delightful, you know, to think about how different the geography, you know, used to be. And we can probably just leave it at that. Yeah, keep going here.
140 million years ago, suddenly, and with only the hint of the two pre-reptilian ancestors that developed in Africa during the preceding epoch, the reptiles appeared in full-fledged form. They developed rapidly, soon yielding crocodiles, scaled reptiles, and eventually both sea serpents and flying reptiles. Their transition ancestors speedily disappeared.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, the transition ancestor comment, you know, is just really reminding, okay, we're this is definitely something that's in the moving forward part, and the fact that stuff right behind it immediately fades away proves it's scaffolding, you know, that you are in a vertical mode of where there's scaffolding, right? This isn't just some tangent going off horizontally. We're looking at what humans were in fact back then during the Mesozoic, right? They were in fact reptiles, right? At one time they were trilobites, right? We're up to reptiles now, is what a pre-human looks like in fact. And of course they always remind us of the suddenlies. Yeah, and they often throw in these little hints about how, the current evolutionary biologists, you know, are trying to find two species that appear to be not very, you know, far removed in morphology or whatnot, and they say, okay, so this one, you know, must have been just before this one, you know, followed by that one. You know, they're trying to do a dot to dot, you know, but they're thinking very simplistically, very linearly. It's not like that at all. It's a very parallel phenomenon. You know, these pre-reptilian aren't immediately pre-reptilian, right? There, you've got parallel stuff, right? And those were parallel tracks. If you think of establishing a plane, you know, and you've got stuff coming up in many parallel tracks. There's stuff just immediately below that plane. That's pre-reptilian. No matter what parallel mode it's in, first thing that pokes its head above the reptilian plane is now reptilian. You know, and not everything pokes up. Some things only need to make it up pre-reptilian and never go any further. Right? They're a vertical dead end. But they were, you know, in truth, pre-reptilian. Even if they weren't literally specifically in a linear fashion, pre-reptilian. Right?
You see, two pre-reptilians do you think they're talking about there?
If you go back and look, there's all kinds of different species. And so the way that would, you know, like I said, who that would speak to is the paleontologist that, you know, know all the details of the fossil record and, you know, are wondering, well, are these the species that led to, you know, and they're giving even you a hint that they developed in Africa. Now, of course, they would have spread out from Africa. So that we found in a number of other places, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if current scientists call those reptiles. And so there's this little hint. It's like, well, technically they're not reptiles, the revelators are saying, you know, the life carrier is saying. Those are technically pre-reptiles. And you can use that little disclosure on my part, life carrier's part, to fine-tune your reflections about the fossil record. That's the kind of clues they're giving for the scientists engaging this. We'll get to sea serpents and flying reptiles, to plesiosaurs and pterosaurs, here in a while more specifically. If you're familiar with the dinosaurs, okay.
These rapidly evolving reptilian dinosaurs soon became the monarchs of this age. They were egg layers and are distinguished from all animals by their small brains, having brains weighing less than 1 pound to control bodies later weighing as much as 40 tons. But earlier reptiles were smaller, carnivorous, and walked kangaroo-like on their hind legs. They had hollow avian bones and subsequently developed only 3 toes on their hind feet, and many of their fossil footprints have been mistaken for those of giant birds. Later on, the herbivorous dinosaurs evolved. They walked on all fours, and one branch of this group developed a protective armor.
Yeah, just about every kid knows growing up about dinosaur books. Okay, just a little aside. When they toss in little things like this, weighing as much as 40 tons, okay, they occasionally give you kind of just sort of, average sorts of numbers. They aren't giving hyper precise, like this is the absolute biggest one that ever was or something like that, right? They're just giving you basic sort of, rule of thumb sort of, median, average sorts of ways. So you can gauge this for the uninitiated. Right, and you get into all the factual details. There's, there's all vast ranges of sizes and whatnot of all these various creatures. But you can see the whole point there. The point is not the facts. The point is, is the contrast there and the truth of that contrast, between brains weighing less than 1 pound and bodies, that are, like in the ballpark of 40 tons. That's a serious mismatch, right? That's obviously going to have issues long term, right? That's not synchronized. Yeah. So the question you can ask is, why do you get such massive sizes? Well, you have a lot of horizontal evolution. Right? When you're back in this mode, giantism is very much giantism, right? But that feeds all the way forward into humans, right? You had giant strains in Orange Man and Green Man, right? Not 40 tons, right? just notice how, those facts that eventually end up in humans, right, they have expressions way back, and sometimes, it's very magnified, that giantism. You can ask questions like, well, you suppose giantism was magnified on this experimental world? Was there greater giantism here than on a normal world? And that's why you end up with any giant strains in humans? Maybe on a normal world you don't get, say Orange Man, Green Man with giant strains or anything like that, right? So you got all those questions. But
what I find most remarkable is that the earlier ones were carnivorous. Only later did they, what did they eat? I mean, there they had to have been eating amphibians or fish or something like that.
Well, quickly, you got lots of different, you got big dinosaurs and little dinosaurs, and big dinosaurs eat little dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs have to, if they're all carnivorous.
Right, but they start out little, and they're eating amphibians and, Yeah, and remember, they're noting that quickly in relative terms, you have some of them going into the ocean looking for food.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and then evolving into a sea creature, retrograde. Okay, let's see here. I think we got everything there, didn't we?
Do you think there's a relationship between the giantism and the small brain?
Definitely the fact that it's still in a very small brain mode means that you shouldn't be surprised if you can get big differentials between brain and body size. I mean, it means it's not in a very advanced state of definitive expression of the purposing. And it's all heading towards humans, where the brain is commensurate with the body. Right? And so the fact that you can get it so not, in proportion, isn't telling you, you're a ways away yet from humans getting expressed. Okay, it gets tighter and tighter and tighter expressed and more symmetric. The more focused the expression, right? You're noticing just a huge asymmetry. It's like how asymmetric your use of the adjutants is initially as a seventh circler, relative to how symmetric it is when you're a third circler. Right, that's a parallel process. Right, initially, your genetic bias may almost totally ignore a couple of the adjutants and really fixate on a couple others. You're very asymmetric, very lopsided in your use of the adjutants. But to get from seventh to third circular is to get that fully symmetric engagement of the seven adjutants. See that? You're seeing a parallel here in the biology. You got this very oblong sort of thing, and heading towards the spherical symmetry, effectively of a human. Okay.
Several million years later, the first mammals appeared. They were non-placental and proved a speedy failure. None survived. This was an experimental effort to improve mammalian types, but it did not succeed on Urantia.
That's a little footnote to get picked up again later on. We probably won't get that far tonight. But this obviously, this fact produces a lot of confusion for the paleontologists, noticing these things, way back then, and thinking, okay, so we've got mammals already back then, but again, it's just because they're thinking so linearly. These don't somehow feed forward, like they're pointing out. These are dead ends, right? You had a little bit of an upward movement to a mammal, but it didn't go anywhere, and faded away. You're still waiting for the proper suddenly to come out of the reptiles into mammals in a way that continues to go up. And like I said, when they mention it later, you'll see a little hint about the specifics of what's going on with mammals. So I'll hold off my comment about that until we get there.
When they say experiment, they mean decimal planet experimental kind of thing in a way?
That's the part that I was saying that we want to kind of wait until do we get to, But just notice that there's this, they say experimental here, and like I said, when we have the context of the other one, I'll speak to that issue, how you understand quote unquote experimental. Yep.
The marine life of this period was meager, but improved rapidly with the new invasion of the sea, which again produced extensive coastlines of shallow waters. Since there was more shallow water around Europe and Asia, the richest fossil beds are to be found about these continents. Today, if you would study the life of this age, examine the Himalayan, Siberian, and Mediterranean regions, as well as India and the islands of the Southern Pacific Basin. A prominent feature of the marine life was the presence of hosts of the beautiful ammonites, whose fossil remains are found all over the world.
Yeah, like, you know, another one like the Alps there. I mean, the Himalaya, you know, that Himalayan stuff used to be way down. Now it's been shoved, you know, clear up into the heights. I think probably everyone has probably heard of ammonites, you know, those big, beautiful, coiled cephalopods that were so dominant and, you know, even came in very large sizes. That's a very classic fossil. If you're curious, do some searching on the web, you know, for ammonites. And you do notice it's very overt there today if you would study, right? I mean, that's a pretty overt, you know, expression there. It's not even, you know, for them to not just in passing, you know, hint at it, but to come right out and, you know, it's almost like, say, if you were to dig in certain regions, you know, in the northern part of the Persian Gulf, you'd find, little tablets with the original commandments carved on them, you know, from Dalmatia. You know, it's kind of that sort of a little aside like that. If you knew where to dig, you could find some cool things. All right, I think we can keep going here. Notice we're still stepping along in 10 million, you know, chunks here.
130 million years ago, the seas had changed very little. Siberia and North America were connected by the Bering Strait land bridge. A rich and unique marine life appeared on the Californian Pacific coast, where over 1,000 species of ammonites developed from the higher types of cephalopods. The life changes of this period were indeed revolutionary, notwithstanding that they were transitional and gradual. This period extended over 25 million years and is known as the Triassic.
So you can see that we're, between 130 million years ago and 120 million years ago is when we're shifting from the Triassic into the Jurassic. Because, you know, over 25, you know, see, it's, you know, it's on a five mark there that it's shifting. Okay, and notice that comment there at the end. The life changes of this period were indeed revolutionary, notwithstanding that they were transitional and gradual. So I remember you saying that a while back. You have a lot of, you know, more horizontal sorts of evolution happening, a lot of gradually, you know, horizontally in contrast to the vertical suddenlies. You know, so you get, like they mentioned there, you know, I mean, over 1,000 species of ammonites. Right? So there's a lot of horizontal evolution, you know, giving you a lot of diversity. So it didn't take it very long, you know, when it squeezed through that little neck of the Permian extinction to immediately flare back out again, you know, in a very horizontal fashion. You would expect it to flare out quite quickly because you've got it pared down to the core phenomenon that needs to have the diversity where somewhere in that horizontal space there's going to be the proper element that can go vertically definitively towards humans. And, you know, that's why it spreads out horizontally.
25 million years seems.
Yeah. In relative terms, right? But it, you know, it didn't take, you know, several hundred million years. So, you know, you can just see how it's a system that is very purposed, definitively seeking the path upward to humans, right? And it needs to explore every horizontal nook and cranny because somewhere in that horizontal space, there's the neck upward. Right, and it's searching for that. Is it here? Is it here? Is it here? Is it here? No. Oh, here it is. And up it goes. Okay. And then it'll search around horizontally again and find that place up. I mean, that's why you have a mind, Right? You have a mind, so you have adaptability. So you can search horizontally for that path of progress that's vertical. That's what you're supposed to be doing. But, you know, think about how most humans don't approach progress that way. All right? They say, well, I want it to go up here. I'm sure as hell not going to move horizontally and adapt any. I mean, the whole universe is going to have to adapt to me. I want it to go up here. Yeah, and I'll just start screaming until it goes up here. I mean, that's the way we tend to think. And see, that's just so false. The reason you were given a mind is so, you know, and external influences that would, if you don't move horizontally, will push you around horizontally. Right? To find that place. Where is the place up? You know, think of yourself kind of taking a spiral path. Right? There's a lot of horizontal searching, you know, but you're also moving up. Mind for the adaptability for the horizontal, a relationship to spirit, so that you can go up eventually.
Just in my experience in my business, mm-hmm. much of the time it's just been maintaining, because mm-hmm. It's not really a growth business. It's
mm-hmm. right.
So it's difficult, but if you maintain and stay and are ready, circumstances will conspire once in a while for an opportunity to suddenly
go up.
To go up. And if you're ready, you can go up. If you're not, you end up staying where you were and you won't.
It's funny you should say it's not a growth business. It's actually a cutting down business.
It's actually a cutting of growth, yes. It's overgrown. Right. But yeah, I mean, see, in that, yeah, you recognize exactly, see, the truth that I'm trying to get at, right? I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, you can't have this self-righteous attitude, right? Fundamentally, nothing is going to go up until not just the individuals, not just the parts, but the whole is all together. Then and only then will anything go up, you know, like, remember the big one of going up from the finite to the absolute. Do we all, you know, is there a first person there who gets to jump over the line? No. Everyone has to get up to the line, and then the Supreme Being lifts the entire finite as a whole up into the absolute. Right? No one can go across. You know, everyone has to go across at the same time. And again, humans are in this very self-righteous mode. They don't think holistically. They may give lip service to that word, but they don't really think holistically, right? Where they're humble and patient for the time to be right. Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus, now he lived it. Right? My hour has not yet come, right? You know, to have the insight and the wisdom to know when the hour has not yet come. And don't be looking for a bigger sledgehammer to somehow break through the ceiling and go up. Who cares, you know, if everything is in order yet? Right? If you do succeed in smashing through and appearing to go up, you won't stay up for long because you're not being upheld. You will fall back down. Right? We only go up when we're, you know, lifted up. Man cannot cause growth.
Doesn't mean you don't look for that hole.
You look, right? You have your eyes open.
And that also has to do with, you know, you're talking about your fondest dreams, you know, crashing, and then you've got to turn around and, you know, take it with a grain of salt and continue to move on.
Right. I mean, if that crashes, you know it wasn't best.
Right. It's like with the old phrase people use when, you know, one door closes, another one opens, kind of thing.
And again, it's because the universe is purposed. Right? But not by us.
Right? We're here to figure it out.
Yeah. You're here over time to slowly, humbly come into synchronization with that purposing and consecrate your purposing to its purposing. But, right? All right. See, so again, like I said, we're talking about dinosaurs and stuff, but I mean, it's the truths that we're reading about that are important. Right? It's another opportunity to see the truths that function in your life, right? And you can't obey the facts of dinosaurs. You can't obey the facts of the life around you right now. You can only obey the truth. And if you can find the truth in the dinosaurs, right, it's easier to find it in your life circumstance right now and obey that truth. All right, let's chug forward into the Jurassic here.
Section 2, the later reptilian age. 120 million years ago, a new phase of the reptilian age began. The great event of this period was the evolution and decline of the dinosaurs. Land animal life reached its greatest development in point of size and had virtually perished from the face of the earth by the end of this age. The dinosaurs evolved in all sizes from a species less than 2 feet long up to the huge non-carnivorous dinosaurs, 75 feet long, that have never since been equaled in bulk by any living creature.
Again, that 75 feet long is like that 40 ton, you know, it's not like that's absolutely the biggest one that ever, right? I mean, they're just giving you, you know, kind of the, you know, the core of it. Again, you're going to have big tails on this experimental world, you know, and they're not trying to give you the facts of the whole spectrum, right? The whole bell curve of distribution of sizes and stuff like that.
How big are the biggest whales?
There's a good assignment for you to look up. What's the difference between the sauropods and the whales in terms of size? There's a homework assignment for you. you know, I mean, if you don't remember from a little kid, you remember dinosaur means terrible lizard. Literally, you know, the S-A-U-R is lizard. So you have this vast, the big point you already, focused on it so much, you know, the big point of them telling you this vast range is, right, there's this intense searching. Where does it go up? Where does it go up? And it spreads out into this vast diversity. Let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Noticing that all of this horizontal is going to go away in short order, you know, like they mentioned there, had virtually perished from the face of the earth by the end of this age. Right? Yeah, and of course, remember, you know, we're coming up on the not meteor, you know, transition, right? It wasn't a meteor that, you know, caused the end of the dinosaurs. You can see, already what it was. It's, you know, it's all just stuff that doesn't go up, yeah. So it's going to disappear. It spread way out. All right.
The largest of the dinosaurs originated in Western North America. These monstrous reptiles are buried throughout the Rocky Mountain regions, along the whole of the Atlantic coast of North America, over Western Europe, South Africa, and India, but not in Australia.
Yeah, just little reminders of, you know, how initially you had things. You know, what was going on, you know, later in the Cretaceous is, you know, another issue. But, you know, just remember that this is a statement very contextually here.
Yeah, you can go to Dinosaur National Park.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and of course, everyone should be, you know, who's familiar with Colorado knows how immediate a lot of this stuff is to right where we are, you know, with the Morrison Formation, which is a Jurassic formation, right? The period we're reading in here.
These massive creatures became less active and strong as they grew larger and larger. But they required such an enormous amount of food, and the land was so overrun by them that they literally starved to death and became extinct. They lacked the intelligence to cope with the situation.
See, again, all facts, but is it not obvious how they're trying to encourage you to about the truth of it by that little parenthetical they threw in the end there? They lacked the intelligence to cope with the situation. That could be you. We could stamp that on your tombstone. He lacked the intelligence to cope with the situation.
So we're
going to
bury him.
Right? We thought he was minded, but apparently not. Apparently had no adaptability. I see, that's what they're getting at. Right? And that's very relevant. Like I said, we're post-Permian extinction. We're in a time where, you know, like they tell us directly, over the next 1,000 years, things are not going to settle down. You will have to adapt. And those who don't perish.
That's not so dramatic as you know, some of the other stories you hear.
Right? Now, of course, remember, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, eternal perishing. I mean, you go on as an individual. I mean, what we're talking, you know, like I said, the parallel is not with your, you know, your ascension career to this biologic. It's the evolution of civilization. Right? Right? And if civilization doesn't have the intelligence to cope with the situation, there will be an interregnum.
They basically ate themselves out of house and home.
Right, and a lot of humans are doing that right now, too, you know? I mean, they're doing the WALL-E thing, you know, if you saw the movie WALL-E, right? I mean, you know, they're turning into fat blobs, you know, just eating themselves to death, right? Right? That's the material comfort era, you know, one of the hallmarks is gluttony and drunkenness, and right? You know, that's sure sign that we're in the material comfort era, you know, that you sort of, you know, caricature it, you know, in that movie WALL-E like that, right? Right, so you see how they're not even sort of, you know, hinting between the lines. Sometimes they're just putting it right there, hoping that you'll reflect on it. And ask yourself the question, do I resemble that remark? You know, am I in this falsely existentialized mode, you know, where, you know, I want to believe that whatever is in front of me is innately divine, you know, and absolutely should not be allowed to change, you know, and any influence that seems to be forcing me to adapt is evil. Think about how we rationalize our lives falsely like that.
how crude terms come.
Here, 1 second.
How crude terms come up to express this, like snowflake.
Yeah, the snowflakes melt. Yeah.
The current scientific thought about the meteor extinction is a result of wanting to deny the intelligent design and things.
We talked about that a little bit, you know, earlier when we were in the earlier papers. You went from the beginnings of geology to, you know, just an absolute rejection of catastrophism. You know, they wanted to separate themselves from the flood story in the Bible, right, basically, right? And say, no, it doesn't have anything to do with catastrophes like that. The history of the Earth is just a long series of basically the processes that we see today, you know, going on over, you know, millions and millions of years at a time, uniformitarianism. But as we, the more we moved into the 20th century, especially as you move past the middle of the 20th century, the greater and greater spiritual influence on humans' minds is more and more driving everything to a primitive religious, you know, ideological mode. Yeah, so science has disappeared, and it's become primitive religion. And primitive religion loves catastrophism, right? And so everything now is getting rationalized, you know, in that old-time religion mode, in a primitive religious mode. You know, so not that many years ago, no scientist, you know, would ever be allowed to publish an article that suggested some wild catastrophe to explain something. You couldn't get published anywhere. Now that's the only thing that's allowed to be published. See, it's just completely shifted. You know, and it's easy. Catastrophes are easy. You know, they're basically magical thoughts. You know, you can make them as radical as you want, and they can solve any problem.
And they're all natural.
Well, yeah, there's also that. But so is starving to death.
Yeah.
Right? Because you've overpopulated.
If nothing artificial.
Yeah, but wow, how unsexy, you know? And it just doesn't satisfy the fact that I've rejected traditional religion, and I'm trying to make my science a substitute for that. I mean, starving to death just, you know, isn't sexy enough to satisfy my religious impulse, my sixth adjutant. I mean, it's got to be, you know, crazy, you know, zealous and animated and dynamic and, right, to satisfy my religious impulse. So we're in this very ridiculous mode now. That you certainly see that, you know, when you read the Urantia book. Seldom is the answer catastrophe. Seldom. The old people reflecting very humbly on the world around them got a true reflective recognition that essentially it's uniformitarianism. Right? It's a long, slow, gradual process. And even the suddenlies are not catastrophes. They're not interventions. Right? Like we talked about, those are natural. Those are phase changes in the system. We need to go back to reflecting on just how profound the inherent system is, instead of bringing in magic external others like meteorites, right?
However,
or the fickle finger of fate.
Our solar system was kind of formed catastrophically.
Yeah,
right. Very small.
It was formed, yeah. So I mean, yes, I mean it's so, not.
But I'm just saying,
it does happen. It's just, you know, you want to avoid
the. Just commented this.
Right, you want to avoid the tendency to go to that first. Don't,
no,
see, that's the whole point. Don't assume that first, like everyone is doing now. And it's, when you get into that mode where you're assuming catastrophe first, you'll never get, you know, to some sort of a prosaic, gradual, you know, approach. Because it's just so much more exciting to think about catastrophes. An apocalypse, and some, you know, radical divine intervention and all these sorts of things. Humans love that sort of stuff. Signs and wonders, right?
Dramatic.
I mean, that's all they wanted out of Jesus. They just wanted, you know, him to be a cool magic man and do a great road show, you know, and do signs and wonders. They wanted free food and free health care, right? I mean, you know, that's all they wanted out of him.
Hello.
Nothing's changed in 2,000 years. Okay. All right, keep going here.
By this time, most of the eastern part of North America, which had long been elevated, had been leveled down and washed into the Atlantic Ocean, so that the coast extended several hundred miles farther out than now. The western part of the continent was still up, but even these regions were later invaded by both the Northern Sea and the Pacific, which extended eastward to the Dakota Black Hills region.
Note that we definitely, you know, kind of the striking thing there is that we're still in a mode where you can have definitive northern intrusions. You know, and the biggie that should remind you of, we're a long ways away yet from having that incredible elevation way up in the northern part of North America that can produce the continental ice sheets yet. It's still so low-lying here that, you know, you've got invasions of the sea coming from the north. So we're a long ways away from being able to have continental ice. Okay.
This was a freshwater age characterized by many inland lakes, as is shown by the abundant freshwater fossils of the so-called Morrison beds of Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming. The thickness of these combined salt and freshwater deposits varies from 2,000 to 5,000 feet, but very little limestone is present in these layers.
So you don't have that deep, you know, limestone, you know, marine deposit stuff. And we already talked about that. There it is, the Morrison, right? That's Jurassic. Okay.
The same polar sea that extended so far down over North America likewise covered all of South America except the soon appearing Andes Mountains. Most of China and Russia were inundated, but the water invasion was greatest in Europe. It was during this submergence that the beautiful lithographic stone of southern Germany was laid down. Those strata in which fossils, such as the most delicate wings of olden insects, are preserved as of but yesterday.
Like a very, very fine-grained, right? So you not only used it for, you know, literally, lithographically for printing, but it could hold, you know, because it's so fine-grained, it can hold fine details if it has a fossil in it. I mean, obviously, if something is really coarse, it's not going to preserve any fine details of some, you know, creature. If you get something that's very, very minute particles, and it can preserve, you know, very, very, you know, just like when you used it for printing, right? You could print very delicate details with something that has such fine grain. Yeah, so printing, using stone for printing plates. And notice the same thing is true that, you know, you can have the southern, you know, polar water extending up, you know, over South America, like they're saying there too. You don't have this state we have now where you think so much of, you have these polar waters, you know, that just, you know, are so separate that we consider them, you know, a separate ocean, even though they're, like, especially the southern one, you know, it's like, how is that separated from the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Indian and right? Let's see, anything else there? One little thing they slipped in there. Likewise covered all of South America except the soon appearing Andes Mountains. See, we're getting close to definitive plate tectonics, right? That's what they're hinting at there, that we're getting close to the kind of mountain building that you get when you finally get definitive plate tectonics.
The floor of this age was much like that of the preceding. Ferns persisted, while conifers and pines became more and more like the present-day varieties. Some coal was still being formed along the northern Mediterranean shores.
Remember I mentioned back during the Carboniferous, you definitely have coal, you know, continuing forward, as we see, you know, even a lot later than this. It's just that you obviously don't have those huge groves of vegetation that can get laid down like you did back then, because the climate has changed, right? You know, so much more regional and less extensive in terms of, you know, at least in some areas.
The return of the seas improved the weather. Coral spread to European waters, testifying that the climate was still mild and even. But they never again appeared in the slowly cooling polar seas. The marine life of these times improved and developed greatly, especially in European waters. Both corals and crinoids temporarily appeared in larger numbers than heretofore, but the ammonites dominated the invertebrate life of the oceans, their average size ranging from 3 to 4 inches, though one species attained a diameter of 8 feet. Sponges were everywhere, and both cuttlefish and oysters continued to evolve.
Yes, some of the ammonites got very large. So notice that even though we've made, you know, the overall shift from marine climate to continental climate, there's still enough variability in how much is underwater and how much isn't that you can get into a mode temporarily where it's a lot more kind of marine climate-like. Okay, and that obviously could cause, you know, more extensive vegetation in some areas that could end up, you know, laying down more significant coal beds. But you see how they made the note. But, you know, it's like, but don't think that we're ever going to get back to, you know, where literally there's no difference in climate and temperature between the poles and the equator. It's never going to get back that definitively into a marine climate. But, you know, quasi that for stretches here. If a lot of stuff is underwater. Okay, let's see, I think that, you may notice how they'll throw in these things about corals and crinoids. Remember, crinoids, the sea lilies. Because a lot of those things have definitive hallmarks in the sedimentary beds, and so giving you those little markers for the geologist. Okay.
110 million years ago, the potentials of marine life were continuing to unfold. The sea urchin was one of the outstanding mutations of this epoch. Crabs, lobsters, and the modern types of crustaceans matured. Marked changes occurred in the fish family, a sturgeon type first appearing. But the ferocious sea serpents, descended from the land reptiles, still infested all the seas, and they threatened the destruction of the entire fish family.
So they just mentioned crinoids. You see sea urchins. So you've got one of those other echinoderms. And sturgeon. Caviar, anyone? right. So. Just these little things you can note there when these various creatures get going. Let's see, I think we got everything there, didn't we?
Big sea serpent threaten all the entire fish family because there must be a lot. I can see them eating the big ones, but they're eating the little ones too.
Yeah. I mean, they're huge and they're hungry, and there's zillions of them, and they're eating everything. All right, so it's just like humans overfishing, areas, with drag nets. There's that stuff between the lines. It's the animals themselves, can be quite destructive of species. It's not just humans.
So they got together and decided to cut back.
they all had an enlightenment moment and decided they would cut back on their eating habits, for the sake of the future of the planet.
Their human potential kicked in.
Ichthyosaurs, have meetings where they want to save the Earth.
Guys,
it's
getting too extreme.
Yes.
This continued to be preeminently the age of the dinosaurs. They so overran the land that two species had taken to the water for sustenance during the preceding period of sea encroachment. These sea serpents represent a backward step in evolution. While some new species were progressing, certain strains remain stationary and others gravitate backward, reverting to a former state. And this is what happened when these two types of reptiles forsook the land.
So you, even though, you have a very much overall upward influence, and one, again, can probably speculate on an experimental world, not surprising that you might get retrograde phenomena. You've got all kinds of parasitic plant life, for instance, right? It's a retrograde phenomenon. Can't generate its own energy, it has to suck off of other things, right? You definitely can have, especially in the earlier stages, some downward, and anti-parallel to the general upward. It just kind of reminds you of how this is being influenced. The fact that some stuff can go downward is a reminder that the system knows where the real future lies. you know, and it's not holding as tight a grip on certain areas that aren't going to get you to will creatures eventually, you know, so much so that it literally can go retrograde. Yeah.
I mean, the man does that. I mean, dark ages.
Right, and that's, yeah, see, so, exactly, see, you noticed that was just what I was going to bring up. The parallel, see, yes, when you think about the civilizational parallel that we're drawing here, we're quivering on the very brink, and we can actualize the potential there in an upward or a downward mode, right? You know, we can definitively move up into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, or, you know, we might go all the way back down and start over again on the nutrition epic. Right? I mean, when they tell you about the interregnum potential, right, they tell you that the solution for humans getting way off in la-la land philosophically and causing the collapse of their civilization, how their heads get cleared of all their foolish thoughts, is fear and hunger. Hunger, that's the nutrition epic. Fear, that's the security age. Right, the first two developmental epics. That'll clear your head of all your foolish notions, you know, these false material idealisms that you were trying to live. And, yeah, but that's tough medicine. But it'll work. You know, if that happens, you know, it can go back to square one and work its way up again. You know, it's in our hands. See, we want it to be that sad to record that we were so clueless that we really, you know, had to have the reset button punched on us like that. Are we going to wake up and start taking delight in cultivating, having enough cosmic consciousness to be upheld and continue to move upward? Remember what they said about these creatures. They lack the intelligence to cope with the situation, right? Okay.
As time passed, the sea serpents grew to such size that they became very sluggish and eventually perished because they did not have brains large enough to afford protection for their immense bodies. Their brains weighed less than 2 ounces, notwithstanding the fact that these huge ichthyosaurs sometimes grew to be 50 feet long, the majority being over 35 feet in length. The marine crocodilians were also a reversion from the land type of reptile. But unlike the sea serpents, these animals always return to the land to lay their eggs.
Yeah. So, you have some that were kind of in that, amphibian mode where they're, a little bit, we know that, kind of living in both. But the ichthyosaurs, the fish lizards, definitively, went fully back into the sea. All right, let's see here. What else do we have there?
This small brain.
Yeah.
Giantism.
Right, right. Yeah, you definitely.
The tendency to get bigger and bigger must have been an evolutionary advantage up to a point, but it was a dead end phenomenon. I mean, it didn't carry to the forward to the future.
You see how much this begs the question for some paleontological reflection, to really see if you can get a better understanding of why there was such a tendency. Is that, like I said, is that on all worlds? Or is that just because it's an experimental world? And if it is only on an experimental world, why? What is it about trying to produce a pre-sangic will creature, that would, have this little, side phenomenon, this corollary phenomenon of, very definitive giantism, right, to the point of self-destruction. I don't know. See, there's just a lot of, true science there that can be pursued there, searching for the answers to those why questions and not just piling up lots of factual information. Let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? I wanted to mention, because you brought this up, sometimes grew to be 50 feet long, the majority being over 35 feet in length. Okay, so, it's a big creature. That, you know, you've got to eat a lot. You know, and you're not talking about like the, you know, the whales that strain plankton. you know. So, they're going to go through, and if you've got, you know, hundreds of millions of these things, you know, they're going to eat a lot of fish. So it can be cataclysmic to the fish population, that many huge creatures.
They probably burn a lot of calories.
Right, too. Right, and they're burning a lot of calories because they're swimming and they're big, right? Yeah, see, yeah. See, you can put two and two together. It's pretty obvious that could be a big problem.
Soon after two species of dinosaurs migrated to the water, in a futile attempt at self-preservation, two other types were driven to the air by the bitter competition of life on land. But these flying pterosaurs were not the ancestors of the true birds of subsequent ages. They evolved from the hollow-boned leaping dinosaurs, and their wings were of bat-like formation with a spread of 20 to 25 feet. These ancient flying reptiles grew to be 10 feet long, and they had separable jaws, much like those of modern snakes. For a time, these flying reptiles appeared to be a success, but they failed to evolve along lines which would enable them to survive as air navigators. They represent the non-surviving strains of bird ancestry.
Okay, so here's very definitive. You see how they're trying to give you an example of thinking properly about the evolutionary process, like I was stressing before about all the parallelism. You know, right in that paragraph, they start with, but these flying pterosaurs were not the ancestors of the true birds of subsequent ages. And then they end with, they represent the non-surviving strains of bird ancestry. And if you're thinking in very simplistic, factual fashion, right, you know, at the very least, you go, I think I found an error in the book, right? Right. It seems to be a self-contradictory paragraph. It's like, no, so you understand now because I've explained it, right? I mean, you know, in the full horizontal sense, they're bird ancestry. But in the specific, you know, what part genuinely went up and continued to go up, no. They weren't immediate precursors. And in the same way that they follow up on that that mammal comment that we got a while back, they follow up in that same paragraph about this. Like I said, so we'll get to talk about that a little bit more. Let's see, but we're not going to get there tonight, probably. So next time. Let's see. What else do we have there? I think we got everything. You notice how you've got this hollow boned stuff going on a lot, right? So, obviously to help with the mass, you know, when you got these really big creatures, if they had solid bones, they'd be really heavy. So they did have hollow bones. That's right. There was one other comment. I knew there was something in there. Again, the size thing, spread of 20 to 25 feet. Again, you know, they're just giving you kind of an average, right? If you go and look at the specifics, okay, you've got some big ones that were smaller than that, some big ones that are a little larger than that. If you take an average of all the biggest ones, you'll get an average between 20 and 25. Okay, that's the way they're talking about. I'm stressing that because fact finder mentalities, you know, look at these passages in the book and get themselves off on all kinds of silly tangents, thinking that they found errors in the book and whatnot. It's like, no, I mean, the whole point is not to disclose the specific facts about pterosaurs, right? You know, the point is to reveal truth, right? And, they're just giving you the basic factual footholds to strike step with the truth through. Right.
The essential knowledge.
Right. Start with truth, then go to fact, and then you won't go off on all these tangents that readers have done for decades, you know, with this stuff.
Turtles increased during this period, first appearing in North America. Their ancestors came over from Asia by way of the Northern Land Bridge.
Just a little tiny paragraph thrown in there. You might have been wondering about turtles. But obviously, the biggie there is their ancestors came over from Asia by way of the Northern Land Bridge, is presaging, you know, what a significant role, right, that land bridge is, you know, plays, as we all know. How did Red Man get from Asia to North America and such things? You know, that's a that ends up being a very big part of the whole story, that one land bridge did remain in play. Yeah. Oh, you got some? Yeah.
Well, I was just noticing when the next one starts, 100 million is the first time they've written it out versus
the
number out, you know what I mean? Numerically. But anyway.
Yeah, and you know, you can see, because we haven't gotten to the official number block, that's, you know, over in the next section.
Oh, yeah, okay.
See? Yeah. Yeah, so they're just okay, speaking in a preface sort of emoji about it. Yep.
100 million years ago, the reptilian age was drawing to a close. The dinosaurs, for all their enormous mass, were all but brainless animals, lacking the intelligence to provide sufficient food to nourish such enormous bodies. And so did these sluggish land reptiles perish in ever-increasing numbers. Henceforth, evolution will follow the growth of brains, not physical bulk. And the development of brains will characterize each succeeding epoch of animal evolution and planetary progress. This period, embracing the height and the beginning decline of the reptiles, extended nearly 25 million years and is known as the Jurassic.
Yeah, it's Jurassic because of the Jura Mountains and the border between Switzerland and France. Jura, you know, just J-U-R-A, Jura Mountains. Okay, so you notice how they're stressing what I was a little while ago. You know, and that it's going to move to brains, right? And the development of brains will characterize each. So what does that mean, you know, more fundamentally? It means we're now seeing the very definitive transition from the beginnings of the adjutants engaging the evolving life on the planet, right, to the higher adjutants being able to come into play. Right? You know, remember, you don't have a sophisticated enough brain until you're roughly age 6 for the 7th adjutant to engage. Right? So, you know, if you're going to get beyond the 1st and 2nd adjutants at some point, this has got to start to really focus in on the brain evolving. Right? Bodies can be whatnot, it doesn't matter. Right? You know, at some point, it's got to start to really focus in on the brain if you're going to get to the 3rd and the 4th and, you know, 5th adjutants. Okay, so that, so you see, they're telling you it's, you know, we're, you know, like I said, I mean, if you come out of that Permian extinction, it has a newfound expression of the truth that's in play. Right? It's very, in very short order, it's getting to the point. Right? We need to get to the point of starting to develop a brain that can be the brain of Andon and Fonta here before too long. Okay. Let's see.
Now
yep.
We just, you know, parallel is now we've got to start learning how to use our brain that we've developed.
Right, right. Now you've got all the adjutants and circuitment and the Holy Spirit, but it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch take delight in cultivating, you know, using any of that potential. Yeah. All the biologic precursor is played out, you know, and you're availing yourself of it not. It's sad to record.
Evolve a mind. Just a brain.
You know, like you hear me say so much, right? I mean, most people go through their whole life as just a fancy animal, Okay. Yeah. Yes, they are genuinely human. They're in circuit in the Holy Spirit. They have a personality identified. But they're not using any of that stuff, right? They're just using their fancy animal adjutant mind, right? They're effectively an animal. Fancy animal, yes, but an animal. You start to really get some sobering reminders of that when you see the way precursors of Andon and Fanta, like, say, mid-mammals, you're going, wait a minute, that sounds like a human. Matter of fact, those are the things we think that really make us human when we behave like that. No, that's mid-mammal. That's way factually pre-human. Right? Right? To be a full-on human, for instance, Jesus said, step one is fear not. Animals fear, not humans. The degree to which you're dominated by fear is the degree which you're not effectively human. You're an animal. Right? It's animal fear. Right?
I think that's what Jesus was talking about when he said swine.
Yeah, don't throw your pearls before a swine, right? I mean, it's definitely a way of reminding you of how animalistic, right, objects that are shaped like me can be, right? Challenge yourself to do more than just, get by with your fancy animal wits. All right, let's keep going here, and we won't be able to read all of the Cretaceous here, but we can get in a ways. We'll see what block we can get to here.
Section 3, the Cretaceous stage, the flowering plant period, the age of birds. The Great Cretaceous period derives its name from the predominance of the prolific chalk-making foraminifers, thank you, in the seas. This period brings Urantia to near the end of the long reptilian dominance and witnesses the appearance of flowering plants and bird life on land. These are also the times of the termination of the westward and southward drift of the continents, accompanied by tremendous crustal deformations and concomitant widespread lava flows and great volcanic activities.
Okay. Right, so Cretaceous, the root there is literally chalk, as you can tell by what they're saying. And you have foraminifers. You have these little single-celled animals that have shells. So you got these tiny little shell creatures that could obviously make very fine piles of calcium carbonate debris, right? Chalk beds. Let's see, so what else do we have there? And then we've got, they're hinting at this stuff we'll get to, like the birds and the flowering plants. But notice, these are also the times of the termination of the westward and southward drift. You can see they're already hinting at it here in this little preface that continental drift is going to be coming to an end. Like we were talking, the obvious consequence is going to be some serious grinding and gnashing of teeth here in the plates of the earth as this stuff starts to really get rigid and clash with one another.
So the continental drift, there must be talking about the separation of Americas from the...
Well, again, I mean, there's still plate tectonics separating things, right? Yeah. It's just not separating in the continental drift mode. It's going to be separating in the plate tectonics mode.
Yeah, but you've got Australia and Antarctica would be southern drifting, I'm imagining.
Well, right now, subcontinent of India is still, moving northward and piling up the Himalayas, and the Atlantic Ocean is opening up, and I mean all that stuff is still happening. It just shifts from drift, to plate movement. That's the whole point. Like I said, I mean you can, initially you can suspect that that's how you're supposed to be thinking, but now when you read this, you see it basically just stated directly, and they say continental drift comes to an end, you're going, what do you mean? I mean, you know, we measure all kinds of movements. I think I found an error in the book. It's like, no, you've found a false assumption on your part. You're assuming that continental drift is plate tectonics. That's a false assumption. Right? You know, it's a separate type of phenomenon that produces an effective movement of continents, but not in the plate mode. Okay. You know, like the westward thing, you know, we're going to, things get hard and North America starts slamming into the Pacific plate. Crunch. All right, keep going there.
Near the close of the preceding geologic period, much of the continental land was up above water, although as yet there were no mountain peaks. But as the continental land drift continued, it met with the first great obstruction on the deep floor of the Pacific. This contention of geologic forces gave impetus to the formation of the whole vast north and south mountain range extending from Alaska down through Mexico to Cape Horn.
Yep, see, here it is very definitively. You know, we are shifting into plate tectonics. You know, initially you don't have mountain peaks, like they're saying, but the basic process that gives you the kind of mountainous terrain that you've see today generated by plate tectonics, we're moving into that mode. See, I mentioned, you know, like one of the biggies is all of a sudden North America comes up against an immovable object, the Pacific plate, is not going to be moved. Right, it just starts crushing and piling up, you know, in its westward movement, you know, against that. And occasionally the middle of the continent gives way and there's, you know, and St. Louis will be flattened, you know, one of these days and that sort of stuff. I mean, that's all because of this, you know, North America meeting an immovable object.
I.e. the Rocky Mountains.
No, the Pacific Plate. The Pacific, the Rocky Mountains and everything is all piling up because of, because of North America slamming into the, right. Right, he starts breaking, you know, breaking things, and all kinds of magma comes up and bulges up the Rocky Mountains, and maybe the thing will be to do. Maybe we'll just read this next little paragraph, and we'll start up, you know, with the official Cretaceous next time here. But see this next paragraph is the official christening of plate tectonics.
This period thus becomes the modern mountain building stage of geologic history. Prior to this time, there were few mountain peaks, merely elevated land ridges of great width. Now the Pacific Coast Range was beginning to elevate, but it was located 700 miles west of the present shoreline. The Sierras were beginning to form, their gold-bearing quartz strata being the product of lava flows of this epoch. In the eastern part of North America, Atlantic sea pressure was also working to cause land elevation.
Okay.
There's gold out of the western Pacific.
There's gold in them bar hills. Yeah, there it is right there. If you wondered when did that get started here, you know, we're to that point. But you see they italicized it, right? If it just to emphasize. Modern mountain building stage. It's during the Cretaceous here, you know, and you'll see they'll mention it in context as they start stepping through, next time when we start stepping through the blocks of time. Right, we officially make that transition from continental drift to plate tectonics, and you can take your imaginary quotes off of the word mountain that in, you know, when it's been used prior to this, right? You know, it, you know, okay, if it was an isolated volcano, all right, you know, but you know, remember how they kept stressing, like they re-stressed there. I mean, merely elevated land ridges of great width, and sometimes of great elevation too. I could point out sometimes it bulged, it bowed up to huge elevations. Now all of that ability to flex something that large, that much, that's gone. It's too rigid. You start to flex it and it breaks now. And you're going to start to get definitive subduction, all around the Pacific Rim. And, those sorts of things are now going to be the order of the day. So, you can see it's not that long ago.
Measly 100 billion.
Yeah, it's like 100. But compared to a billion.
True.
See, so... what this stress is, I said it a long time ago, think about how problematic it could be if you assume the current plate tectonics can be extrapolated backward. You can just take the movie, film, and run it backward and think that you can, a geologist can extrapolate plate tectonics back to, 800 million years ago and tell you what the Earth looked like back then. No, it's a completely invalid extrapolation. All those things that you see where they've, extrapolated plate tectonics back like that, extrapolating it back prior to the Cretaceous, you're going to diverge further and further from what it was actually like back then. It wasn't plates until this recently. And you just, not only just those projected maps of what the distribution of the continents were like, hundreds of millions of years ago that you might see in a book or, Wikipedia or whatnot, just also all the local things where, if you're reading one of those things and they say, well, for instance, these rocks indicate, that there was subduction, here or... all of those are false interpretations. Right? They need to rethink all of those kind of localized interpretations that are predicated on that big picture false extrapolation of plate tectonics. Not unlike, as we mentioned, when you started to get continental climate, you definitely alpine glaciers. And sometimes, a regional sort of a glaciation, but no continental glaciation. And so all the times way back then when the current, geologists are saying, oh, there was continental glaciation way back there. No, that's a false extrapolation of a localized thing, way too extensive. So they have all these false extrapolations both temporally and spatially.
Plate tectonics... the science of it, doesn't that date back only to about the middle of the 20th century?
If you were taking geology in the late 50s, you weren't taught plate tectonics.
Right, I remember.
That was woo-woo.
I remember the Scientific American. Yeah. I carried that around for years.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of geologic thought prior to that. That could be closer to the truth than what has transpired since that time.
You can see that it's not unlike, when I was talking about uniformitarianism and catastrophism and this definitive bias that everyone has now towards catastrophes for explanations, for rationalizations of things. There's a lot of potential value in going back to a time that's not so far back that you didn't have enough of a philosophic framework that they were attempting to work in, but back before a lot of these simple-minded tangents took hold. Like you've heard me say about if you want to... get a fresh start on fundamental physics. You need to go back to the beginning of the 20th century, and you need to rethink that stuff. Because basically everything since then has been going off on false tangents. All these primary theories we have, those are all false. You need to go back to, and you can, you can, if you get a book, a fundamental physics text from the early 30s, it's still integrous enough that you can read that and get some help, like you're saying. It's like, how did they think about it back then when they were still staying objective and reflective before they got all, falsely focused in and quasi-religious, and going off on tangents with their thinking? So there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Are you talking pre-quantum mechanics?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, right? You need, you don't want to go... rationalizing things with quantum mechanics. It's not that quantum mechanics doesn't give you correct answers. It does. I mean, we wouldn't have it if it didn't give correct answers. But, it's obviously a false theory because its initial assumptions are the assumptions of magic. And it assumes magic, fundamental principles, or general relativity, right? It gives you correct answers, but it's obviously not a true theory because it falsely reifies space and time. All these things, you need to go back and, you need to remind yourself that the point of science is science, knowledge, not information and rationalization. Science is not gathering information and rationalizing it. You can rationalize anything. Right? And there's 100 million false rationalizations, but only one true one. Right? The whole point of the scientific method is to try to weed through patiently, methodically, over time, through all of the endless potential false rationalizations, right? And try to find, if you can, the true one. Which rationalization is true? You can believe anything. You can rationalize anything. You can confirm anything. You can confirm false theories. Like I've stressed so many times. Right, I mean, you can assume that plate tectonics goes all the way back, to 1 billion years ago, what they think of as 4 billion years ago, radiometrically. You can assume that. And guess what? You can rationalize everything predicated on that assumption. It all seems to work spot on. You get all these confirmations of that assumption. We've forgotten it doesn't mean anything. It's because it's confirmed. It doesn't mean it's true. Right? How many people understand that? Right? Say when they're thinking about politics, someone gives you a confirmation of a political theory, and you go, "Oh, well, that's true then." No, that doesn't prove anything. You can confirm false theories. Right? How do you know if something's true? That's a tricky question. And we don't attempt that anymore. We're willing to just take someone's rationalization that gives us a pleasing feeling because of our preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, and we join the religious fanaticism about that ideology, and we're all just happy as pigs in mud. Right? But that's what we are, pigs in mud. Right? We're not availing ourselves of our human qualities.
Sea serpent.
Yeah.
So how do you propose we test?
Right. The fundamental process of a truth seeker is you attempt to refute. Okay? Now, remember, you can rationalize anything, so I can always find a negating rationalization of something. That's not what we're talking about. Right? You try, it's this very methodical, objective process of you, initially you that have discovered this area of pursuit, you trying to come up with a hypothesis, and trying to refute it, and if it seems to resist your efforts to refute it, maybe this is can be put forward as a theory. I can publish it. And the idea of publishing is to try to get as many other people who are interested in that area to join in and see if they can figure out how to refute it. Right? And if all the people that are interested in that area over decades are or centuries can't find any way to refute the theory, well, maybe that theory has some truth to it. Right?
The statement with Paul, with if he is of God, how can we stand against it?
Right, so you're looking for that which stands unmoved. Right? It's the truths of eternity. They embody the constancy of eternity as opposed to the fluctuations of time. Right? You're looking for that fact that stands unmoved. Right? You're a true seeker is one who's seeking that which stands unmoved in midst of all of that which, you know, is effervescent, okay, about you. But, you know, when people don't know what the word truth is, I mean, you know, they don't know what it means to be a truth seeker. Most people think that a truth seeker is, you know, is a fervent believer. I mean, you can believe anything, right? You know, like we'll use the expression true believer. Yeah, that's a ridiculous expression.
We're all true believers.
Right? Because again, I mean, that sort of a mode, right, it's just, it goes nowhere except self-righteousness. You know, if your definition of goodness is, well, if I have a pleasant feeling in response to that stimulus is good. Oh, so you're the definition of goodness, huh? I mean, just think about how ridiculous that is. Right, you know, when you go, oh, I like that expression, about Jesus, that he went about doing good. Well, that's a dandy expression, but if you don't know what the definition of the word good is, what good is that saying? Right? I went about doing things that produced a pleasant feeling for me. Is that what Jesus did? That's
sure,
not what...
Feeding the 5,000, you know? That was good.
I mean, these sorts of questions. You can go on and on. This is a general problematic issue. It's the lack of a recognition of this is why the book is in my lap. Remember, it's that philosophic crisis that has led to the emergency to put this book in my lap. Right? We are quivering on the very brink of the collapse of civilization because it's sad to record that no one is taking delight in trying to approach their experiences objectively anymore. Right? Do they, when they have a spiritual experience, do they go at that spiritual experience as a truth seeker? Or they attempt to refute all of the effectively infinite number of false interpretations of that experience? Because they want to find the truth of that experience and obey only that? Or do you just want to find some immediate rationalization, which is erroneous, and follow the error? Right? You can obey falsehood. Right? And it's just as delightfully holistic as obeying truth, subjectively. Right? I mean, you know, give the so-called truth seeker the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's a holistic understanding seeker, but he doesn't know that there's an infinite number of false holes and only one true hole. And you got to find the true one. Right?
One spelled with W.
Sing Langton knew that there was one truth. He called God, right? The one truth. Right? Right? There's one truth, and you're seeking that. It doesn't matter if you're a paleontologist or a religionist or whatever. If you're trying to interpret, you know, the observations of material facts or the experiences with spirit substance, it doesn't matter which substance it is in the external world, right? We need to pull back on the reins, step on the brakes, as we're plowing headlong right, into an interregnum, the mode we're in right now, where all the only thing that the only demand we make of something is that my interpretation is pleasing to me. Okay. Truth is rugged. Truth initially is not pleasing. Ultimately, it is, but not initially. Initially, it's a bomb that goes off and blows up your worldview and all of your old modes of pleasantness. Right? It shatters the illusion of success. So truth is not for those timid souls who can only keep up the struggle of life by the aid of continuous false illusions of success. And the revelation is looking for that small number of people on the planet who are ready for the rigors of being a truth seeker and not the pleasantries of belief. finding a pool of affirmation to live amongst. So we'll get back into this here, the details of the Cretaceous here next time. You can see it was very easy to take the story of dinosaurs and immediately bring out, right, what the truth is that we're trying to get at here. As we saw in the Carboniferous, from that point forward, it starts to get more and more poignant in terms of immediate relevancy to you to reflect on what's going on. Right? It gets more and more tangibly pre-human in what's going on. Trilobites are pretty remotely pre-human. But we're in the mode now where things have a lot of immediate, obvious parallels to what's going on with you individually and what's going on with us collectively as a civilization.
It's fun, too, how they talk about the finiteness of cold beds, because you're not always going to be on a cold diet. And they see that as part of your progression.
Like we talked about, the cold is an inescapable means to a greater end. Right, there is no magic way around it.
But it's not an end in itself.
Yeah. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.